Welcome to AMO Kenzoku. We are a group of four Bubble Bum Crisis Boomer Otaku who talk about all things anime, manga, and other related topics. The Kenzoku are...
Hey all, I'm Mike.
Hi, I'm Dylan.
Hey, I'm Sam.
And I am tonight's host, Nick. We are recording episode 62 on December 12th, 2024. And a little bit of a curveball, we decided to change the topic from look back to Tokyo Godfathers, because 'tis the season. And I am actually hard-pressed to think about another more Christmassy anime movie than this. So I think it's a very apropos topic. And with that, Ashin. So... I guess going to the details first. So Tokyo Godfathers is Satoshi Kon's third feature-length film. It was released first in Japan on November 8th, 2003, and then very soon thereafter in North America in January 16th of 2004. So the turnaround from its premiere to U.S. distribution was actually quite short, which I think is kind of a... We were talking about this with Paprika, how during that era, it was definitely, you know, kind of the anime boom era still, so we were getting a lot more stuff transferred over. At the time, though, I would say this still predates Paranoia Agent, so I think this is still before Kon was kind of in a more breakout stage of his career.
He had definitely gotten attention from Perfect Blue and Millennium Actress.
For sure. Millennium Actress was 2001 or 2. I don't recall. But this was after Millennium Actress. I think he, according to the wiki anyway, I think he pitched this pretty much as soon as Millennium Actress wrapped up and Madhouse greenlit it basically right away. So, you know, definitely still kind of in, you know, working close with Madhouse. Cost-wise, budget-wise, it cost $2.4 million, so not too far off from what Paprika cost, you know, a few years later. Did not do great in the box office. It looks like it made just around $850,000. So, you know, did pretty middling, I would say, at the theaters. But I feel like Christmas movies don't necessarily do great in Japan. So that's kind of the impression I get. And
yeah, they don't have that same seasonal movie thing that we do where we see a lot of movies.
Yeah, where trashy Christmas movies come out and everybody watches, even though in my opinion this is an excellent Christmas movie. So and then maybe other notable staff wise, I would say notably screenplay done by Keiko Nobumoto. Also did the screenplay for Cowboy Bebop. That's probably what she's most famous for. Also Wolf's Rain, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, pretty notable writer for sure. Music was Keiichi Suzuki. So this one was not a Susumu joint with Kon. But
which is weird because they're, one of the ending credits song sounds like a Susumu song.
Hmm, interesting. I didn't really pay attention too much to that, but I don't know. I'm not sure if Susumu's sound would have necessarily thematically matched as well.
Definitely not, yeah.
So, you know, though, so I know pretty bare bones with the background, but maybe go into plot since that is kind of important. So, you know, obviously spoilers abound since we are going to be talking about the movie top to bottom. So plot, I would say this is probably the most grounded plot that Kon has done. It's basically a story of three homeless people, a, middle-aged kind of surly alcoholic gambling addict named Gin, a trans woman, and former, like, kind of almost, like host singer, like host bar singer, named Hana. And then a teenage runaway named Miyuki. So it's kind of this really interesting ragtag group. And they, it's Christmas night, and they're just getting their, you know, free Christmas dinner. And then are kind of scrounging around for some you know, freebies and books behind the I guess the church that they were getting the food at, and suddenly they hear the cries of a baby and discover an abandoned child in that pile of books. And literally the entire rest of the movie is this constant daisy chaining of a spiral downwards in them trying to take care of this baby as three homeless people, and also ultimately trying to find her parents. Would that pretty much is the core of the movie. What it really is a series of chain vignettes kind of showing the hijinks of these three homeless people trying to, you know, like, protect this baby in a winter in the middle of Tokyo. And, you know, in the Paprika episode, I recall saying that I thought Tokyo Godfathers was Cohn's weakest entry. I don't know if I necessarily still feel that way. I do definitely feel like Tokyo Godfathers is by far the most straightforward story that Cohn has told.
Definitely.
And it's not to say that it's bad. I think, I think that Tokyo Godfathers is kind of Satoshi Kon trying to do, like, a, air quote, standard movie plot. And there's still definitely very Kon-like twists at the end, particularly the end. I would say the last 10, 15 minutes feel very Kon-like.
I mean, I would even say twist. That, like, more than just the last 10, 15 minutes, almost the whole movie, for me anyways, like, it was constantly surprising me with all the, like, quote-unquote miracles throughout. And, like, if I was less engrossed in it, I probably would have, I don't know, predicted some of them, or like, oh, of course this is going to happen or whatever. I don't know, but I was always caught by surprise. And I had forgotten everything that happened in this movie, pretty much.
Yeah, it's funny. Same. I remember so little about this movie.
I really remembered the characters well, but the events a little less.
Especially the whole mafia assassination yeah. part. I was like, oh man, I completely forgot about this part, especially because the whole arc where, yeah, the mafia, you know, they save the mafia don, so to speak, and then turns out his soon-to-be son-in-law was, like, the guy that grifted Gin, and then Gin's about to, like, basically annihilate him with a wad of wine, and then he gets basically assassinated by, like, a South American rival gang member, for lack of a better description, who then ends up kidnapping Miyuki and the baby, and it turns out he just didn't want to hurt them, so he drops them off at his wife's place, and then there's a whole, like, 10-15 minute segment where there's an attempt at a conversation to be had between Miyuki, who only speaks Japanese in very broken English, and then this this gangster's wife, who only speaks Spanish and very broken English, and I thought that was such an interesting scene.
Yeah.
Especially because, I don't know for you guys, so I watched it on Prime, and the Spanish portion language was not translated.
There were no subs on the Blu-ray either.
Yeah. Okay, so it's intentional, which I think is okay.
I like that because it's kind of like, it's how the Japanese would see it, right? Like, they have no idea
And it also kind of immerses you in the scene, like, in Miyuki's shoes, too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as a Californian, my high school Spanish is just good enough to pretty much pick up on what was being said.
Exactly. And especially at the very end when Hana actually finds them and the lady comments, is this a lady or a gentleman? And my wife, funny story. So my wife ended up watching this movie with me. She rarely does, but she's been feeling under the weather. So I asked if she wanted to watch a fun Christmas movie, and she's like, sure. And that particular scene just made her chuckle because she was a language major in college, so understand Spanish very well, and she was just like, do you understand the gist of it? I'm like, yeah, I get the gist of it. And then the part when she comments about Hana being either a mom or a lady or a gentleman, and I just cracked up, and we both kind of chuckled at that scene because it wasn't like an accusatory tone. It was just like the character almost thought of it as like a minor miracle. And there are a few gags like that, right, where the one of the volunteers at the church kind of was, you know, giving Hana the stink eye because she was asking for more portions because she might be expecting, and then later on she's there with the baby. She's like, well, I guess miracles do happen.
So oh, that was her. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't make that connection.
Yeah, so one thing I noticed about this film, there's a lot of, I would say, situational humor. To me, that felt very American in a lot of ways.
Hmm.
And I guess, at least based on the wiki, I guess, like, this movie was inspired by an American film called The Three Godfathers, which is, like, an old movie made in, like, the 40s, I think. Starring, like, John Wayne, like, it's that era kind of movie. But I think it was loosely inspired by that. So I think that's why it feels a little bit more Western in some ways. Not many. My wife definitely said that it still definitely feels like a Japanese movie, which isn't a bad thing.
Yeah.
Especially because it takes place in Tokyo. One thing I thought was interesting was how this movie very much did not glorify Tokyo very much, I would
Yeah.
say.
Showed all
It
the
kind
darker
of,
sides of it, right?
right, like, yeah, like homelessness definitely exists, right? I mean, Japan brags about having only whatever, like 4,000 homeless people nationwide, but that's because the way they classify being homeless is a very nebulous kind of statistic. So, try to sweep under the rug.
I mean, every country tries to do that at some level. Do you think it's at some level, are there fewer? This is kind of a complete aside, but do you think it is actually a reasonable reflection of reality that there are fewer homeless as a percentage of the population than other places, or do you think it's just grossly underreported, even more so than the US?
I think it's a combination of the two. I definitely feel Japan has less homeless per capita than other modernized nations, especially the United States. But I definitely feel they also do absolutely underreport. I've seen there's some really interesting Japanese-based YouTubers who kind of go over it. Not they don't try to turn it into a hit piece. It's more of like a this is the real homelessness situation in Japan. It is different because even the homeless in Japan kind of abide by a significant amount of the Japanese kind of social norms and ethics still. Like, the homeless understand that because they cannot conform to the Japanese normal standards of living, they are the ones that have to kind of make sure that they stay out of the way of the rest of the people and not be a nuisance or, a significant drag on society. Like, it's an interesting kind of microcosm of like Japan as a society, because yeah, they definitely have their homeless who are have their mental instability issues. I think the elderly gentleman that had asked Gein for help with his last rites and everything, right? He was kind of an example of one of those, and he ended up being possibly the most pivotal character because he gave Gein the lottery ticket, right? So that's the one thing that was interesting with the movie. There's so many layers weaved in with every interaction. Like, there was not a single interaction in the movie that was purposeless. Everything connected to each other in some way, even if it kind of was loose. So I thought that was pretty cool. Just go ahead.
Sorry, on the homelessness thing, I thought that was interesting because it's right underneath, they're set up in this park, like right underneath the government buildings at Shinjuku. And I remember seeing pretty much exactly that setup in that park, walking around that government building, a couple of years after this was made. And I was like, watching that, I was like, oh yeah, that's exactly what I remember it looking like, with these kind of semi-permanent structures that are set up,
Like shed-like structures with
but they're
tarps on them,
all
right?
meant to be, but in, like you said, they're all clear of the walking path, and you almost never actually see homeless people outside anywhere.
Yeah, they're very out of sight.
Yes, it is, as you say, it's very much like they understand that they also conform and in their way of being out of sight, which then also lets them be not harassed by police and whatever.
Yeah, the one place I remember seeing them in 2017 was around like the north side of Shinjuku Station. But otherwise, they definitely stay out of sight from what I can remember. But I'm sure they're there. Just not at w levels that I'm used to living in coastal California, let's put it that
Yeah,
way.
we're special.
And it might also be too, like I don't know that it might also be too that the way that particularly being that we're non-resident Japanese, that the way that homeless are there may be less stand out-ish from the way that a lot of homeless are in particularly coastal California. They may be more invisible.
I think it's the whole, again, they're still, even if they are homeless, they're still intrinsically Japanese, so they just try to not rock the boat. And my understanding is that, there's a lot of my information is from various, like, YouTube kind of experts, so, you know, take that as you will, but they're not, as far as I understand, the homeless people, while they do build these sheds, they still actually have to make them relatively transportable, because my understanding is that police still do some sort of regular sweep to clear them out, at least for a time being, to make sure if the area is, I don't know, you know, free of, you know, dangerous levels of, you know, filth or what have you. And so the people usually have to relocate for a temporary amount of time, and then they tend to, you know, repitch their houses, air quotes, after those, you know, sweeps are done. So it seems to be kind of like a social contract with the law enforcement, where as long as they play by a certain set of rules, they're allowed to mostly be left to their own devices.
That feels very Japanese-y.
Yeah, and, you know, is that good, bad? I mean, you know, it's a thing. I also do think that it's interesting that they intentionally added a scene where there were a group of thugs who,
yeah,
you know, basically, like, were okay committing murder. I mean, they were beating, you know, Gin and the other gentleman, who I think was already deceased, with like, a pipe. So that was an interesting kind of scene. It was jarring. It was comfortably the most violent scene in the movie.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was like, unsettling, because it felt really believable. As far as kind of just, you know, the situation and, you know, what was happening. And
it must be a thing that happens in Japan. How often, I don't know, but it feels like something that I've run into in other depictions of Japanese homelessness, like in Yakuza 0.
Yeah, so, you know, I think certain things might be embellished for the sake of being a movie, but the fact that that particular, you know, theme comes up again and again in Japanese media must mean that there's some element of truth to it, which is sad, because obviously there are people in the States who, you know, I wouldn't say, like, hunt homeless, but they, you know, they certainly don't, they look at them with disdain and kind of, well, you know, are happy to tell a homeless person off and give them their opinion on why they you know, being homeless is 100% their fault and all that, but to the point where you're outright assaulting them is like, wow, that's particularly kind of harsh and dark and very not Japanese. But I think that's what Kon was going for, though, was she wanted to kind of show an element of Japan that maybe the average person doesn't see. I don't know how much like research she did for this with Japanese homes. I truly don't know. Again, if he actually, you know, tried to find homeless people and talk to them about it, that'd be pretty cool. But I can't find any sort of
also evidence kind of
that was how it was done. So
it's kind of a like showing all sides of their life, right? Like, this is all the crap they have to deal with, like, you know, no money, no food, punks come and decide they just want to go beat them up randomly, like
normal people hold their nose whenever you get anywhere near.
Yeah.
That felt very Japanese, like Americans are smell sensitive, but not quite to the absolute same degree.
I would agree.
I don't know. I felt like to me, it felt like a statement about how bad they smelled, right? Because Japanese generally don't speak
visibly,
up about
publicly,
things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's a thought, like, too, yeah.
I will say that scene was very funny, though.
Yeah.
The way they're just
up a little bit,
acting normally, but everybody else is like, oh, no, these guys stink so bad. For me, that was the point of the movie when it started to really pick up.
Yeah, I just feel like on American public transit, no one would comment about that because it's just almost expected.
Well, also because they're afraid that the person is crazy and then will come and, you know, assault you.
Possibly armed.
Yeah. Personally speaking, that's more my experience when there is, you know, somebody who either I perceive to be or, you know, obviously is homeless that is on public transportation. I just try to try not to pay much attention because it's hard to know. And it's sad that it's that way, but I mean, it's unfortunately that way because the edge cases are what dictate people's expectations, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So, the other thing I found that, and I think Sam brought it up, about how this movie is kind of held together with all of these miracles, right, that keep happening to make the story go in an interesting direction. And all of them always pivot around the baby who Hana kind of gives the name, Kyoko, which, you know, is kind of like, it kind of means like pure, like blessed child or pure child in Japanese. So it's a very, you know, there's kind of a heavy religious intonation with the baby because it starts with this kind of Christmas manger scene done by this Japanese sect of a Christian church, which was a real interesting and intentionally uncomfortable scene, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did it so well. To go through, sit through that sermon so they could eat.
Right, so they could just get their free food. I thought that was pretty interesting. And yeah. My wife was kind of like, you know, smirking because it's, you know, she's experienced that. Where she grew up, because she grew up in a pretty rural part of the country that was very religious. So,
yeah.
But yeah, this whole time she was just like, man, this kid is literally blessed. And I'm like, yeah, that's kind of the whole gimmick in the movie, and it works really well, I think. Again, I felt like all of the threads tied together felt very consistent. Like the story to me, it's hard for me to poke too many holes at it because it felt very consistent, and yeah, even if it was predictable, it still felt like it was woven together well, as opposed to Paprika, where I felt like it wasn't always woven together well, but it was when it was working, it was like so great. And then sometimes it just kind of completely like just went off the rails and made no sense. But
for me, this movie, when I was watching it, it started out pretty slow. And I was kind of like enjoying it, but like not super into it. But yeah, I think once they got on that train and things started going, oh man, it just got better and better and better. And like, cause these, you know, just say the miracles kept happening more and more and more. And they were very, interesting. The kind of the vignettes, right? Like when they're in the graveyard, and they're, you know, drinking, booze, Gin's drinking booze and they're looking for food or whatever.
Yeah. These are offerings to dead people. And yeah, like basically, you know, and technically it's for a good cause, right? It's for Kyoko, so, well, you know,
and then they see that car, right? And then as soon as they get past the car, it's like, there's a dude under the car. Like, I just burst out laughing because I, like, did not see that coming. And it just seems so random. And then, like, from there, yeah, it all gets crazy.
Yeah, that crazy ride in some ways reminds me of, oddly enough, not Satoshi Kon's part of the anthology, but Stink Bomb from Memories a little bit, just with the improbableness of the situation and kind of the little bit of trail of destruction they leave in their unwitting behind them and near them.
Not in the same way, but kind of like a Coen Brothers movie where it's kind of like people trying to solve a mystery. In this case, it's okay, how do we get this kid back to where it needs to go? I thought that, the scene with, I thought there was a lot of the stuff I liked in this film was that very grounded, dirty underbelly of Japanese society showing it and not glorifying it or not really passing judgment on it, like of the homeless stuff and like them kind of going to seeing the graveyard and being like, hey, check out what we got here. And like, oh, mm-hmm. And of course they go in there and take the offerings. But it's one of those things you wouldn't think about, and no one in, you know, polite Japanese society would ever consider such a thing. But they're just like, oh yeah, of course, yeah, we need these, so we take them.
Yeah, but they're very aware at the same time of like, you know, we shouldn't be doing this, but you know, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, what are we gonna do? We got needs.
Although one thing I didn't pointed out to my wife at the time because just it was kind of dark. But when you think about the, and then there was another minor miracle, right? Like there actually was an offering of baby formula and diapers,
right?
At one of the things. Mm-hmm. But that also infers to me that that grave was for probably a baby that passed away. So I'm thinking like, ooh, that's a little dark. But then again, it doesn't need it, so
right,
you know, might as well use it for a baby that's in need, and that worked out. That worked out pretty well. I also like how throughout the movie, you're also not, you know, in the, it's layered. So what I was saying is layered well, right? And one of the other layers that does well is you're, throughout the movie, you're getting pieces of each of the homeless people's kind of pasts, like coming back into the movie. The first was actually Miyuki, right? Like, you know, she's a runaway because she seems to be one, very young and plucky, and two, well, one, young. Like, usually you don't see homeless that young. Like, she was like a high schooler.
Mm-hmm.
And two, you know, doesn't sound like she's uneducated or anything. Sounds like she ran away from home for a probable good reason, and you're not really sure why. Mm-hmm. But then that, in the train scene, you know, she's stopped, and another train stops next to her, and you don't even need to hear the dialogue, but you can just, that scene was so brilliant because you could just, so from the situation, understand what exactly was happening. Because she sees a gentleman across, and then her eyes go wide, their eyes meet, and then suddenly she freaks out and starts to crawl out the window, and like immediately, at least in my mind, it was like, oh yeah, that's right, that's her dad. And so,
yeah, see, I didn't catch that when I was going. Because at that time, I was like, because I think they had been looking at the pictures, and they were like, I thought, oh, is that one of the guy from the picture? Because he looked kind of similar. I don't know. Maybe I'm just kind of face blind, but like, I didn't really get it until later.
I thought that at first, but then her reaction made it pretty clear to me that it was her dad.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't clear to me that it's clear to me. It was obviously it was someone that recognized her. Something. Yeah. I was like, oh, is this like a cop or something who's like looking for her? That was kind of my thought.
Mm-mm-mm. Okay. Well,
technically. But...
Yeah, that's also true. Yeah. Yeah, because at the very final scene, the detective that air quotes solved the crime, right? Was he really just kind of walked into it, and it ended up being her dad. And the final huh? And to close the whole movie.
Yep.
And you're just like, and you know, the little pouch falls and you see the lottery ticket 11111 on your, like, oh my gosh, like that's the final piece, the final pieces of the puzzle sliding into their slots. And then of course it cuts the credits and it lets you fill in the gap. But you know, I feel like that at that point, you know, everything has to probably lead to a good direction, because at that point the other two kind of reconciled with their air quotes family. So, you know, I think that was, and that's okay. I think having a Christmas movie end on a kind of a surprise feel good moment is totally appropriate.
Yeah, the movie earns it for sure. After going through all that stuff, you see that they start out as pretty miserable characters, and you like them most. I'll just say they, you're like for them mostly out of pity in the beginning, right? Because you don't really know them, but. By the end, they've really earned your care, and they've fleshed out as like real humans. Like they're not just homeless garbage, right? They're, and so like it just feels like a, I don't know. Oh man, you guys have been through so much, and you guys try so hard. So yeah, here's your whatever. Here's your lottery prize. You win. You deserve it.
Yeah. First, you get like the version of their history that they are willing to tell each other, and then a bit more of it comes out, and that. Contrast between the two is interesting.
That's true. I didn't really think about that. We get two histories for them all.
Yeah, well, especially Gin, right? Like he initially leads you to believe that he's the most tortured character because he lost everything, but turns out he's just a pathological liar.
Yeah.
And a real sack, right? He's a real sad sack. And even then, you know, he goes through a significant, you know, amount of physical trauma and physical and mental trauma. And then just the hospital scene, right? Like just hits you out of nowhere, like blindsides you. And you know, it was such an interestingly awkward scene to watch him and his daughter kind of like, you know, talk again after probably, you know, close to 20 years of no contact.
That was tense, and, too, right? Like, when that happened, I was like, ooh, this could go one of two ways, and one of them is very badly. And like,
right.
Like, she could just hate his guts and, like, oh, we've got to argue about stuff. But, oh, okay, she really missed him and is so happy to see him. I love that.
What's so funny is, even though he has not been a father to her, still fatherly tendencies came out. Like, when she mentioned, oh, I'm actually going to be marrying that doctor. And he's like, what? He's like my age. And then he realizes it's not his place to say it, right? Because, like, what right does he have to be critical about his daughter's choice? And then she explains, well, you know, he actually had a daughter and wife that he lost and all that. So, you know, he's a piece of
Yeah, the interesting thing is his story is a lot actually, like Gin's told his story as.
Yeah, he actually is what Gin's, you know, made-up story is. And he's, you know, obviously he's a doctor who is just trying to do his best. So, you know, I thought that was a real human feeling scene. Like, I don't know, I felt like it was super believable. Even if I can't say it's relatable, it was super believable to me. Yeah. And a scene that I would like to hope actually can happen in real life, you know?
Yeah, for a movie with all of these miracles, believable is, oddly enough, the word that comes most to mind for it in a lot of ways, because it just feels very authentically real.
Right. I would say the only miracle probably that was a little far-fetched was the final scene where, you know, the tense scene where I can't remember the name of the woman, but the one that basically was mentally ill and stole the baby, and she was, you know, she ended up jumping, and then everybody's diving trying to save her, and people are, you know, falling on ledges, and then the baby gets flung, and Hana makes the, you know, miracle dive and grabs onto the banner, and you're just like, what is going on?
Yeah, that's the most magical, realistic part of the movie. Like, everywhere else, Khan leaves it ridiculous but plausible.
Exactly. Exactly. Which was, again, really impressive. Like, this movie made me kind of respect his ability to just, like, weave a really tight, good story, even if it's contrived. Mm-hmm. Like, he was able to make a pretty, I mean, a Christmas movies, everybody kind of knows how they're going to end, but a good one makes you enjoy the ride. And I would say this is a very good one, because the ride was fantastic. Like, then the payoff was almost better. Like, everybody basically got what they deserved at the end. And then some.
Yeah, so. This isn't just far and away the best anime Christmas movie, but it is a really good Christmas movie in general, even for having very little actual Christmas in it.
Yeah, totally agree. I would say it's more like a Christmas New Year movie, because obviously Japan's more about New Year.
Dylan, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to ask, Nick, what was your wife's opinion and feeling of it?
She liked it. She was kind of just incredulous at the end, because it's like, how lucky and how blessed is this kid, actually? It's like, yeah, the final scene was definitely a little bit far-fetched, but, you know, she was enjoying the movie. She was, you know, poking around on, I mean, she's sick, so she, you know, her attention span isn't the best, but she was poking around on her phone during slower parts, but, you know, there were definitely parts she enjoyed, like the whole mob portion. She was just like, what? Like, she's like, excuse me? And especially after then, it even humanizes the mobster guy, because he just kind of dumps them off at his apartment, but he leaves them with his wife, who's actually a very caring mother. Like, she ended up feeding the baby, because she was already nursing her own kid. So, you know, just you know, and again, a very human, very, you know, human moment there. She enjoyed that part, and especially because the Spanish was, you know, accurate. Which they actually, and if you look at the credits, there's actually two, like, people who were credited who were very obviously not Japanese voice actors. So
on the voice actor thing, that's actually, that was kind of interesting. The main three voice actors really have not done, like, anything else.
Like, yeah, I know,
like, almost almost nothing. And they've, like, the guy who played Gin has been around. He was born in 1944. Hana was. Wow. Born in 1960, and then Miyuki was born in 1982, which is, you know, reasonably long, but it's like, no, they just, at least according to ANN, which is pretty good for all of these things, and they've done very few other things. The guy
anime-wise, at least.
Yeah, at least anything that's reported on there. But even, like, it's not even a lot of acting stuff for any of them either.
That really surprises me more than anything, especially for Miyuki's voice. I thought she was really good. Like, her range was so impressive. Like, she kind of was this, like, snarky, surly, typical teenager, pain-in-the-butt teenager, you know, but had this real, you know, but still felt very, like, vulnerable and relatable in a lot of ways.
Looks like Gin is a staple of Taiga drama, so.
That could be. He's the one who has the most... Yeah, the one who's had the most credits. And there's probably a lot other things that are not credit, obviously, but I was very surprised to be like, oh, they haven't... It's, you know, usually people like that have been like, oh, I've been at least in like 20 different things or something. It's like, no, like hardly anything.
Oh, wow. Actually, Hana also seems to have a lot television stuff in Japan.
Okay.
And I guess, it looks decent amount of movies, but they only have a Japanese wiki entry.
Mm.
But yeah, not animation, it looks like. Just these are all like drama and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense for Hana and Gin, because the way those two characters were portrayed, they felt like the most, air quotes, real to me, like the least anime-like in the entire movie as far as their overall performance. Although, honestly, Gin had the most slapstick as well, which I enjoyed. But
I mean, really great too for people who that clearly don't do like voice acting. It is a specific skill, and they
very
were
much
incredible.
So. Yeah, they were great. Yeah,
they were great, and it was a good choice, I think, to go for not as anime voices for the more grounded characters.
Well, especially for me, Hana, right? Because what a complicated character, right? You're told so you're an elderly trans homeless person who used to be a lounge singer at a, you know, at a trans host bar. You're like, whoa, wow, that's a, and to be fair, in Japan, that's actually a lot less, I would say, unusual, historically, because there has always been host bars that that cater to, that where all of the hostesses are trans. And there's a very a significant, I would say, audience for that, a very specific audience for that in Japan. That is, always has been. So it's not as weird as even, I mean, when you think about it, this movie's been 03.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Definitely shows up in enough other anime. Everything from City Hunter to Speed Grapher.
Like the concept of a bar mama being like a trans woman is very normal in Japan. Like, incredibly normal.
And such people are usually, honestly, portrayed pretty well in anime, honestly. Though often much more for laughs than they're portrayed in this.
Yeah, one thing I found interesting, obviously the subtitles were on for me because my wife was watching. You know, more of a sign of when this was translated, but it was interesting the vocabulary they opted to use, because the term they used for Hana is in Japanese is the word okama, which doesn't have like a real accurate translation these days, but it generally is used to as a kind of a slanderous term for a man who's trying to portray himself as a woman. Like, that's kind of like the best explanation I can give, but they use some interesting translations to convey that word from what I saw. The one that I'm more comfortable using is I saw that they use the word homo, which I think is probably closer-ish. Although I don't like, because technically speaking, most trans Japanese women are not surgically don't go through surgery. I would say more behavioral than like physical changes that they go through or like, you know, hormonal or anything like that, because Japan doesn't really allow for that. So
they tend to also be more of the, like, obviously not my place to examine this corner of the culture, because it's, you know, it's its own subculture in another country, but like it tends to be, seems like it's more the stereotypical flamboyant, like, gay stereotype we have, you know, we used to have in America.
Yeah, that mixed with like drag queen is probably the best way to put it. Like, I would say in what most Americans would consider Hana would be more a drag queen than like a trans person. And that's in Japan, generally speaking, that's what trans women are. They're generally more drag queen like because of, again, governmental restrictions on various procedures. But that whole scene where Hana went back to, you know, to her home bar, and like the mama of the bar opens up, and it's just this ancient person, right? Yeah. Like, just looked like I can't remember the name of the character, the witch from the evil character from the
Cruella de Vil.
Well, Cruella de Vil, like a Disney villain almost,
like,
right?
Like Yzma, Yzma from
Yzma. Yes, yep. Yes. That's exactly what I thought she looked like. She looked like Yzma from Emperor's New Groove, and he just kind of leaps into Hana's arms, you know, and they just have this, you know, real, like, just vibrant embrace. And that whole scene was just so hysterical, because, like, that was when Gin was being saved. Like, you're starting to wonder if this is where it becomes Satoshi Kon movie, because he sees, like, an angel, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a hostess at this bar.
Yep.
So I'm trying to figure with that as well, like, how do we feel about the, like, you know, coming from where we are in culture, like, how do we feel about that portrayal of Hana and the language and the subtitles and everything there, and how they use that, and would that turn someone off from the movie? Like, because immediately early on, like, in almost like one of the first scenes, there's like, you know, a hardware in the text of it, it says like, oh, you know, this, I think sometimes I'm pretty sure it is like, it's like, oh, what is this? Something that's like, what is this get doing here? And that came off to me as like really harsh. And that, I'm like, ooh, that, okay.
Yeah.
I'm
in my opinion, I don't think the term will come up necessarily carries the same weight.
Yeah.
As that word. I was like, whoa, that's a little harsh sounding.
Yeah.
Also a word that was a lot, I would say, used a lot more loosely, especially in like 03, 04.
Yeah, it's one of those things too. I'm like, okay, yeah, is that like part of it is there? The other thing I did notice is that, like, I think they did a good job in the subtitle stuff generally. That was the only time they used that. And then they had some other stuff where, like,
Do you remember what part of the, what scene that was in?
I don't, but it was very, it
really
was
early.
Really,
I would
early
say first 10 minutes.
Yeah, in the first 10
yeah, yeah, me too. I'm just trying to remember if they retranslated that for my version of the Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember it. Maybe that's why. Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, because I do remember they retranslated something, and I think that was, that one word, I think, is definitely something that they changed for the current script.
Maybe now's a good time to ask, so how did everybody watch the movie? I'm assuming, Dylan, you also watched it on Prime?
I did on Prime. It was the most convenient
for me.
And then
Sam, what about you, Sam?
I, like Mike, I watched the Blu-ray.
Oh, okay. So, interesting. Yeah, that must be the difference then. So, I guess for the Blu-ray, they did another patch, which is great, because I think that is probably a necessary correction. Interesting that Amazon didn't bother to
that explains why you guys are talking about them saying that, and I'm like,
I
feel like I would have been shocked, but that I wasn't. Maybe it was like appropriate at that time, like, so not being there makes sense.
Okay,
so yeah, if you want a more accurate translation, folks, watch it on the Blu-ray. that's who seems to be pretty clear now.
Okay.
Finger waggle at Amazon for not, I mean, not that surprised, but like for not spot checking that a little bit better. But
okay, well, that's good. So, that's good to know, because that was the kind of thing where I was watching on my own. I was like, ooh, I don't know, because I was trying to watch with my wife. It just didn't work out for timing. I'm like, I don't know if she would be willing to be like, nope. She might just be like, I'm out on this movie if that's what they're doing. Like, I don't need that.
Yeah, which is totally valid, but also unfortunate, because that is not at all how, in my opinion, I don't think that's how Hana is portrayed in the movie.
No.
I actually think,
no.
I mean, Hana is pretty much the whole time trying to do the right thing the entire movie. Like, she is one of the few characters I would say that is, you know, short of her one main faux pas, which is what got her kicked out of her host party with, which was hilarious. A hilarious incident, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I would say she's one of the only mostly clean characters as far as like her track record. So
I feel like all the characters in this movie, right? It starts out and you basically judge them based on your assumptions, right? And so the Hana being, you know, the Okama character carries all that kind of baggage of being a bit of a gag character and all that stuff. But like, as you watch the movie, right, it tells you that this is more than just a gag, right? This is a real person who has had a tough life and is trying to be a good person, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear that she would have given anything to actually be able to have her own baby, like you, like pretty clear with how much she treasured and protected her. But and that scene, right, where that she and Miyuki were suddenly were walking on the bridge and just happened to be walking by a person yeah. who's about to jump off said bridge, they stop, and then again, more miracle surprise happening, as it turns out to be, air quotes, you know, Kyoko's mom. And as she lunges for the baby, you see this just very abrupt slap across her face. And, it, you know, that was such an intense moment, but you could just see the real, like real seething anger as far as just, you know, Hana as a person, what she would have done to have and keep that baby, and how this person basically, you know, left it for dead.
Yeah.
I really liked the way they did that shot where they're walking past and you just see her
nonchalantly taking her shoes off. Yeah.
As they're basically describing what she's doing while not looking at her, right? Like,
yeah. Just another example of how tight the script and storyboard for this are. I'd love to see the storyboard for this.
Oh, yeah. Practically a manga, I'm sure.
Willing to bet, yeah.
The talking about Hana and her face expressions with Sachiko made me think of how great the facial animation is in this movie. One of my favorite bits is when Hana's ranting at Gin in the hospital when he's with his daughter, right? And it was just, I don't know, it feels like just 30 seconds of Hana like ranting, and her face is just, it's amazing, fantastic animation. I don't think I've ever seen that much focus on really good expressive facial animation in something that's otherwise like tries to be really realistic, like just made really great use of the animated medium to kind of give it that extra push.
Yeah, that's actually something I've been wrestling with while we've been talking, because you mentioned the Coen brothers earlier, like, would this have worked as a live-action film? I feel like you certainly could have done it had you had, like, someone like the Coen brothers, their level of budget, their level of CGI in The Big Lebowski, say. You could handle all of the surrealistic bits of it, but I feel like the facial expressions really humanize the characters in a way that actual humans honestly might not.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, so that's like a reason why this is just really better as an anime than a live action thing. Yeah, I agree with that, I think.
I'm trying to think
on
that.
I do agree with Mike's point, though. Like, out of all of Coen's movies, this is the one that could be a live action movie, probably the easiest. just because how the lack of relative little use of like fantastic elements, and it's mostly, you know, just good dialogue and obviously good animation. I mean, for a movie grounded in reality, it's real easy on the eyes still. So,
yeah.
The other thing I thought was interesting was that the homeless people take better care of their own surroundings than some of the people who are housed in the movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of,
that's true.
There's a lot of the interesting contrast and stuff where you get into the jerkwad husband's house and you're like, oh, this is way more of a mess than the homeless person's thing. And I you know, that's all, everything is, as with everything with Satoshi Kon, it's all intentional. Mm-hmm. It's not, and I think that's the thing of his stuff, of like all the effort he puts into everything, you know, and all the other people working on the thing, not just Kon, but We'll give him credit here. Everything is all very intentional. The contrasts between things, the way that people do things, everything is carefully thought out. I haven't watched Perfect Blue in a while. I did get the Blu-ray of it, but same. I think this might actually be my least favorite Coen movie.
It says something about how good he is, right?
Yeah, he's, yeah, and right. It's not, and I think some of it, honestly, I think if I watched the other subtitle translation, I think that kind of like, it honestly, it set me off a little bit. I was like, whoa, what is going on here? And so it took me kind of a while to get into it. Like, it's still like, it's an excellent movie, and this discussion has been cool because I've kind of picked up and appreciated more stuff. I'm not sure if I would put it as like one of my favorite Christmas movies. I don't think it's one that I would be like, oh man, we have to watch this movie every year. It's such a great Christmas movie. In my head, I don't feel like it's something that I personally classify as like a great Christmas movie. I think it's a great grounded movie that shows a lot of these unexposed aspects, particularly of like humanizing homeless people and culture and how some of that stuff works, and particularly in the Japanese world. I think it does a really good job at that, but frankly, I miss the crazy fantastical stuff that I love in the other Coen things, where you're just like, whoa, mm-hmm. This is so cool, and something that couldn't have been done. Like, this is one, I think it's a fair question. Like, could this have done live action? And I'm like, yeah, you could do this movie live action. It would obviously be slightly different, but mm-hmm. would it be necessarily worse? And I think my answer is no, I don't think it would be necessarily worse.
That's probably fair. I feel like they squeezed the best out of the medium for this kind of a movie, though, that they could have.
I also agree with that. Yeah, I still probably lean towards this being Coen's weakest work, but it's not to say that it's a weak movie. It just means that I think his other three really show what his strengths are, which is, again, using the anime medium to do what it does best, which is portray really fantastic elements that would, you know, at least back when he was doing it, be impossible to do live action, and now it only can be done with investing hundreds of millions of dollars into a movie. Mm-hmm. So when you think about this can be done with a, you know, $2.5 million budget versus a $250 million budget, I think that you know, is it says something about the versatility of the anime medium, right? Oh, actually, I guess that since we're closing in on 10 minutes till the end here, I wanted to actually add a minor correction a little bit earlier than normal because it ties in with what we were talking about with Paprika as well. So Tokyo Godfathers cost $2.4 million, Paprika cost about $3 million to make, and I think I commented in the Paprika app that an episode of Arcane, the League of Legends animated series on Netflix, costs somewhere in the neighborhood of $7 to $8 million. I was actually off by quite a bit. I've seen official statements that said that both full seasons collectively cost $250 million to make, and that is 16 episodes. So it's about $12.5 to $14.5 million for a 20 to 40 minute episode for each ep of Arcane, which is like, yeah, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
So that is a lot.
I can see where budgets like that coming in would be industry distorting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I hope, you know, we can save the argument of whether Arcane is anime or not for another episode. But I would say that is far from the norm in the anime industry, like the complete opposite. And I think it was more of a perfect storm of Riot Games having a near infinite budget because they have an infinite cash money maker in an IP,
mm-hmm.
and them finding a studio that fit their design philosophy. So you know, if it was Madhouse that approached them with an idea for a League of Legends anime, I think the budget per episode would probably be a lot lower. is my guess.
Yeah.
But nonetheless.
I mean, also, like, you pay that much money to ensure that the quality stays at the same level throughout, right?
Exactly. And I haven't watched all of Arcane, so I can't say if it has or not. My suspicion is it does, because the reception for both seasons has been nothing short of exceptional. So, you know, I've watched a handful of episodes, and, you know, it's different, is what I can say. I'll leave my opinion out of it, but it's the animation, I could say, is I can see the quality and the effort put into it. Yes, that much I can say. But going back to Cohen and his filmography, so, you know, we've watched half of it now, and for the sake of this podcast, in Paprika and Tokyo Godfathers. And I guess, you know, as we, you know, have a few minutes left, I guess maybe spend the closing minutes kind of revisiting the question, you know, so now, having rewatched, you know, Paprika and Tokyo Godfathers, has anyone's perception or opinion on two things? On one, what of Kon's movies would you recommend to a person to watch first? And two, which movie do you feel is the strongest? So I think I'll have Dylan open up with his replies.
Going on the ones that I've seen recently, which is Paprika and Tokyo Godfathers, I would say for anyone, I think is really, like, you see, this is Paprika. And it's, I think, for some of the reasons where it feels like this is much more of a straightforward film. But I really like the discussion, because I think it's made me feel like, oh, there is so much depth and cool and nuance and stuff in there. I'll also throw in my favorite scene is the ambulance miracle where they get out of the
it has so much
Japanese stuff in there as well, where they're in the convenience shop and they're hanging out there, and then they get, like, asked to leave because they're causing a problem, even though they really aren't. And then they start getting really harassed by the drunk upstanding citizen.
Yes.
It's a really great scene that way. And then they go out and the ambulance goes plowing in there, and then the ambulance driver pops out and he's like, can someone call an ambulance?
And it's, yeah. And it's so perfectly deadpan is why I love it so much.
So I ham-fisted that in there. So that's from my opinion. I might also put Millennium Actress at the, it's the problem with this stuff, is it's all so good and all kind of very little bit different takes for different types of people. Be like, oh, for you, I'd go with this one. For you, I'd go this. For you, I'd go this one. And it's one of those things that just kind of like, you know, the rock band, you know, Nirvana, where you're like, oh, gosh, if he had been able to do a fifth movie, like, would have been another crazy, like, he was working on one after Paprika. But it's like, how many more interesting things would he have seen? Would he have gone back and done another, we'll call it a slice of life film like this one? But unfortunately, we'll never know.
Yeah, but that being said, it comes back to my statement. Again, only four movies, but I feel like within those four movies, Korn really hits a huge spectrum of kind of just content and topics and reach to, like, a huge spectrum of people just in four movies. So I still stand by that. I think that's really impressive. Sam, what about you? Has your perception of anything changed now, having watched Tokyo Godfathers again?
I think I'd have to get through Perfect Blue and goodness, why am I blanking on the other
Millennium
one?
Millennium Actress.
Yeah, maybe. Well, let's see. I think I just have to watch Perfect Blue again. But I still think, for me, Paprika is at the bottom. I think Tokyo Godfathers right now will be sitting at number three. I still think on rewatching, Millennium Actress will come out at number one. But I'm gonna have to watch that again soon just to see, and then Perfect Blue, which I remember nothing about. So, for me, it's the the big thing about it is it's the story, I think, is so much better and cohesive in this. And like we were talking about earlier, I think he does a fantastic job with the animated medium with this movie, even though, yeah, like we say, technically you could do this live action just fine. But it is his concept. So nobody else would have made this movie. So I think that makes it special.
Interesting. What about you, Mike?
Yeah, honestly, Sam stole a lot of my lines there, because I would also put this probably at number 3 and Paprika at number 4. And in my recollection, though, we'll see if it still holds on rewatch, Millennium Actress at the top and Perfect Blue behind in second. But this is a really solid movie and probably the one that I'd recommend to most people. If someone was a real cinephile, I might point them to Perfect Blue or Millennium Actress, depending on their taste. But for most people, I would start here.
Yeah, I think I would agree. echoing Mike and Sam. While I probably would put Tokyo Godfathers not far behind Paprika, I probably still think it's Kon's weakest movie, but it's also probably to me his most recommendable movie at the same time. And I think that's more of a testament to how well written it is and how what a cohesive plot it is. It's the least esoteric of his movies by far. So I think that makes it more accessible, which means to me more, recommendable. But I also feel like it also kind of leans away from his biggest strength, which is showing really cool, visually kind of jarring stuff and still making it, in a way that is still like interpretable to me, which I think is a really cool skill that he developed. Pending rewatching Perfect Blue, Millennium Actress, it would probably currently be Perfect Blue 1, Millennium Actress 2, Paprika, then Tokyo Godfathers for me. I've watched Millennium Actress the most because I showed it to a lot of people like early on when I first got it, and I kind of overdosed on it. I don't know. Again, for me, it's a personal taste thing. I just like murder mystery thrillers, and that's why, Perfect Blue speaks to me more pronouncedly than the rest. But Tokyo Godfathers, notwithstanding, still, it might possibly be the best story that Kon has told. Obviously not purely by him. The screenplay was written by him and Keiko Nobumoto, which could be a huge contributing factor as to why it's such a strong plot. Obviously,
she is good.
She passed away, I think, in 2017 or 2021 from esophageal cancer. So I'm assuming because of stress. And yeah, she was only 57. She was very young.
Oh my gosh.
Really sad. Yeah, real tragic. Another titanic loss for the industry because, you can't... when you talk about writing, like Cowboy Bebop is... it regularly comes up as one of the best. And so she was, responsible for that. And Wolf's Rain. Which was also really good.
And Macross Plus.
Yeah, Mac going back. Mac Plus. So, truly a master of the craft. And her and Kon working together on this showed how they can both really work off each other and maximize, a pretty mundane and, contrived plot and still make it a really enjoyable movie. So, that's it for Tokyo Godfathers. I think, despite many of us saying maybe it's our least favorite of Kon's movies, it's again not to say that it's a bad movie. It's still a really, really great movie. Highly recommend. It doesn't even have to be Christmas time. It doesn't have to be a Christmas movie. It just happens to thematically fit for the time of year. I think next we are going to... well, actually, we're not even sure anymore, given the time of year, since it's almost Kenzoki time as well. So, next episode can be a surprise. It will either likely be Golden Boy, or Look Back, or our Kenzokis. You'll have to see. So, with that, this is AMO Kenzoku, signing off. Saraba.